From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley. And this morning, we first speak with biologist and author Karen Lloyd about her newest book, Intraterrestrials, Discovering the Strangest Life on Earth. Lloyd shares a firsthand account of the hunt for life beneath Earth's surface and what scientists are learning about unique types of microbial life and how some of the most extreme locales on the planet are broadening our understanding of what life is and how its earliest forms may have evolved.
That's right. Then in the second part of the show, wildlife photographer Will Burrard Lucas discusses his experiences photographing some of the planet's most elusive and endangered animals in Africa, notably from Ethiopia to the Congo. Environmental awareness and education, that's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
We are really excited to first speak with biologist and author Karen Lloyd. Now, Karen has written a new book called Intraterrestrials, Discovering the Strangest Life on Earth. Karen, thank you for joining us here on This Green Earth.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. First, we like to start with your background and then we'll get that understanding of what an intraterrestrial is.
Cool. So I did my undergraduate degree in biochemistry at Swarthmore College, and I did my PhD and master's in marine sciences at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. And then I did a postdoc in Denmark at Aarhus University, which was kind of cool to give me. It was, I don't know what it was technically in, but I was at the Center for Geomicrobiology. And maybe that's a word people don't know, but that's what I do is geomicrobiology.
Amazing. I like that.
You have a very fascinating background. And this all brought you to penning this new book, and it's titled Intraterrestrials. Now, this is not a word that you stumble into quite often. So can you tell us how you came up with this title and what it means to you?
Well, it's sort of like the reason I chose the word intraterrestrials for the book is that it encompasses a lot of the It carries a lot of weight as a word, because what I'm trying to do in this book is sort of introduce people to a biological world that isn't often talked about. And I find in conversations with people don't know that it exists. And so that really was my motivation for writing the book was, you know, literally walking along the street and looking at somebody on the street and thinking, oh, you poor thing, you don't know the cool things that I know about life on this earth. And I want to share that with you. So this intraterrestrials is about life inside Earth's crust, which is not, you know, it's sort of in hot springs like Yellowstone. That's definitely part of it. And maybe that's a part that people have heard about. But there's so much more than that. I mean, there's tiny cracks and little crevices to hide in. And our crust is basically just completely marbleized with living beings.
And by living beings, are we talking about mostly at the bacterial or even smaller level?
Yeah, so bacteria is a word that sort of is a branch, one of the three branches of the tree of life. There's another one called archaea, which you can kind of lump them together with bacteria in your head, but they are all tiny single-celled organisms that maybe you could put those into a single category in your mind, but actually when you start studying them, they fan out into much more diverse groups. So for instance, everything in the surface world that we touch and think about on a daily basis either breathes oxygen or makes oxygen through photosynthesis. Like that's it. Mm-hmm. It's really just two processes. But all this life in the subsurface, they can breathe pretty much everything on the periodic table. You know, they can take sulfur, pure sulfur, things that look like minerals, and turn it into life.
So when you define these microbes, how do you declare them alive? Like how do you, when you're bringing them in, what's that declaration of life?
Oh, that is often a huge struggle.
Right.
We often have to leave open the possibility that what we're studying is dead on an individual cell basis. But across the entire community, we have a bunch of different ways of knowing that they're alive down there. One is that we can see the slow accumulation of waste products from them. And we can see that they use up food slowly over time. We can see that they have the presence of small biomolecules inside their cells that would have degraded if, you know, these deposits that we find are sometimes tens of thousands of years old or even older, and no RNA, no small fragile biomolecule is going to remain intact for that long. So the fact that they're intact, they're maintaining their bodies, they're producing waste, they're breathing, they're eating, we can see all these things happening.
How do they fit into the larger ecosystem around them? Are they a source of food? Are they helping, like you said, maybe allude to, helping to break down waste products or something like that? What is their role in the ecosystem?
Depending on that ecosystem, they have a bunch of different roles, because, you know, we're talking about a layer of earth that's covering the entire earth, that's underneath the layer that we interact with. Mm-hmm. So in the same way that you couldn't say what the single thing does that life does at the surface of the earth, well, life does a lot of things. You know, we oxygen, we break down carbon, our fungi recycle it. Deeper down, they're doing all the same sorts of things, but doing them just a little bit differently. So they don't have the sun, but they have things that are like plants. They're called chemolithoautotrophs. And so they are producing biomass, they're dying, they're feeding other things. From our perspective, they do a couple of things on an immediate level that really help us out. And one is that they recycle a lot of nutrients. Mm. So a lot of the things that they work with, like nitrogen and phosphorus and iron, are things that we are completely dependent on. Our oceans are dependent on these elements that have sort of been released by the subsurface and come back up and can seed our phytoplankton populations that can like make sure that we continue to have oxygen up at the surface. So they're sort of providing that ecosystem service for everybody up at the surface.
The book describes you venturing into extreme locales to research these biological phenomena and non-oxygen environments, so volcanoes or undersea vents. Where did you go and what did you experience?
Yeah, I'll go pretty much anywhere as long as it's pretty safe. Believe it or not, I'm not an adrenaline junkie, but I do like to go to meet these. I really like that word you just used, biological phenomena.
Yeah.
They're so different and weird. It's like, right. What do you call them? I have been in multiple submersibles to a mile deep and half a mile deep in the ocean in both the Pacific and the Atlantic. Well, I guess the Gulf of Mexico. And it's just a privilege to get to do that. It's not something that we have the resources to have a lot of people do. So whenever I get the chance to go to the bottom of the ocean, I take it pretty seriously and try to use my time wisely. And volcanoes are also attractive, because anything that sort of automatically brings what is deeply buried inside Earth's crust up to the surface is going to be a point of interest for my work. So while there aren't living microbes in lava, that's too hot, it would break down cells. All of the volcanic activity brings up these nutrients that are from the deep earth that can sustain these populations. So then we look at the areas around volcanoes and sometimes in the craters of volcanoes to see who's sort of buried down, nestled down in the deeper reaches that's using all these chemicals.
And when you're studying this, how do you determine the age of these? How do you know how old they are? Because I'm imagining they can be thousands, maybe even a million years old?
Yeah, so that is something that we are actively working on. As far as the age goes, the thing that we can really put a date on is the layer of geological formation that they're sitting in. Mm. That's the thing that we can date. And we can also often know what the history of that has been. So I study some ancient permafrost in Siberia, and we can look at the crystalline structure of this frozen soil and see that it has never been unfrozen for a million years. And so in those cases, we can say, okay, the organisms that we find here have been, either they or their lineage have been sitting here for a million years. And what do they look like? What, you know, are they alive? Do we find evidence that they are living? Are they intact? And if so, have they changed at all? And as far as we can tell, there's not a lot of change that happens over these million years that things are buried. Mm. You know, it's just, we can, it's not just permafrost, it's also deeply buried underneath the oceanic sediments. And there's not, if we look at the total energy that's available to these things and the rate at which it's delivered, it's not enough energy to really sustain a lot of cell divisions. So our assumption has to be that they are as old, that individual cells may be as old as the layer of sediments that they sit in, which could maybe not be true, but to a first approximation, that appears to be true.
Wow. When were these microbes first, I don't know, say, discovered or so? I mean, was Humboldt aware of them? Was Darwin aware of them? Were the scientists back in the, you know, 19th or 18th century aware of microbes?
I would guess not. I mean, microbes, sort of Edward Koch is credited with the first pure culture of microbes in 1885. I think he cultured Bacillus anthracis, which is the normal soil microbe that produces anthrax. Before that, there was Antony von Leeuwenhoek, who developed the first microscope in like the mid-1600s, I want to say. And so he's credited with being the first person to actually like see these things. I think he called them animalcules. I don't know how to pronounce that word. So for centuries, scientists have known about the existence of microbes. You know, this is something that's really flourished. We know that there's a huge diversity of microbial life on Earth. They do a huge diversity of things. They grow on petri dishes. They grow in your laboratory. Sometimes you wait overnight and they're fully grown, teeming mass of cells, and you can do all kinds of experiments on them. And this gave us enough to chew on for hundreds of years that we never... You know, we never would have known that anything else was out there. You know, there's plenty. Isn't that enough? All the great diversity of bacteria that exist. But then we got a new toy. And the new toy is DNA sequencing directly from the environment. Mm. So not sequencing an organism, not like taking a blood sample from something and seeing what its genome looks like after we already see the thing, but rather just like pulling up some muck from the bottom of the ocean or filtering some seawater or, you know, just grabbing some dirt. And that, we can extract the DNA from that. And that's when, I would say in the late 80s, kind of in the late 90s is when this really started becoming democratized and lots of us were doing this. We were like, oh man, we were missing a lot. There's so much more in there.
And so much more, I'm supposing.
Yeah, it's the thing is that we already had a huge diversity of life that we knew about from growing all these cultures. You know, we, with the larger weave, like the field of microbiology, I certainly don't take credit for that.
Right.
But when those of us who started looking at DNA sequences directly from the environment started doing that, all of the DNA sequences I was pulling out of these hydrothermal vents or methane seeps, I shouldn't say all, the vast majority of them looked nothing like anything anybody had ever grown before. So even with the great diversity of microbial life that we had known about, we were finding even weirder stuff. Phylogenetically speaking. So they were deeper branches on the tree of life, whole new phyla. Like a phylum is a very high level of the taxonomic groupings. It's like all of invertebrates are a phylum, I think. I'm not so good at my animal taxonomy, but it's really a very high level thing. And we were pulling out new phyla like daily.
It's really interesting to me to try to wrap my head around these microbes and these spaces in the earth that we would consider to maybe be very inhospitable for anything that's living. Have you studied them long enough? Are they reacting to climate change? Can you see any changes or differences?
Does that matter to them? Yeah.
And does it, matter?
Yeah, that's a great question. Certainly it will matter in some areas. So one thing that is definitely going to matter for them is when we actively put things down into the earth, which is not necessarily a bad thing. So there's a lot of climate change mitigation strategies that involve sticking liquidized CO2 back down into spent oil wells or deep saline aquifers to try to lock it up and keep it as a way to sequester that. And so that is absolutely going to affect these populations. And then the big question is, well, how are they going to react to this over the short term? And then over the long term, are they going to help us or are they going to just spit it right back out at us and, you know, basically gum up the works and precipitate everything out and make us unable to put any more down there. All that is really a very nascent area of research, and we need to figure a lot more out about it. But certainly, just in terms of like the things that are the natural things that are changing with climate change, it's going to change basically their interface with our surface world. Increased rainfall is going to change the delivery of materials down to the deeper subsurface. Changes in organic matter delivery to surficial sediments in the sea are going to change their ability to work with things like methane. So I think that the deep down ones will be affected when we actively inject things into their world, and the ones at the interface are going to be affected by, you know, all the other things that we're affected by for climate change.
We're speaking with Karen Lloyd. She's a biologist and author of the new book, Intraterrestrials, Discovering the Strangest Life on Earth. So Karen, is it possible that these intraterrestrials might be found in extraterrestrial settings, i.e., you know, Mars, Venus, et cetera? Is there curiosity about that?
Man, I hope they're there. Wouldn't it be great? There's absolutely, I would love it. You know, when I look at the surface, you know, the images that people are taking of Mars or Europa, that's just, you know, we don't see life flourishing at the surface,
right.
But it could certainly be there because I, you know, in my job, I look at landscapes that are just as desolate looking as Mars or Europa, and I know that they have lots and lots of different, diverse microbial life there. So when I look at Mars and Europa, I don't see certain desolation, especially when you dig back the layers and you're more protected from UV radiation. I think that there's a lot of good places for microbial life to hide. So my assumption would be that a lot of planetary bodies have microbial life. We just need to disprove it.
I said, I don't know if that's a good thing or not, Karen, because if that's discovered, or if there's, you know, better thoughts that there is microbial life like that on Europa or Mars, that means our multi-billionaires will spend even more billions of dollars to go to those places rather than spending their billions of dollars to finish exploring this planet. So that's where I come from there. Because there's so much more
fair enough.
To explore. Your work is evidence of that.
That's right.
What's the next exploration you're interested in? Where do you want to go next? What's left to be explored about this, about these microbes?
I mean, I think that probably the thing you should take from my book or my work is that when it seems like everything's already known and the textbooks have pretty much got everything sewn up tight, that's not true. There's so much more to be learned. So my next work is in back to the Arctic. We're going to look for some more in permafrost. We're going to look for some more delicate biomolecules to see further evidence at who's actually alive in the places that we've been looking. But I'm always game for anywhere. And there's so much that we haven't explored all over Earth and inside Earth.
Right.
How would you describe the way in which you present the information in this book? For example, for the layperson like myself, if I pick it up, can I grasp it? Am I reading the sentence over and over and looking up the words, 60% of the words? Or
I hope not. I'll tell you, the way I wrote this book is that I wrote it in my most communicative, non-jargony, not for a scientific audience, for a general audience. I would write a whole section as forwardly as I could, and then I would set it aside, and then I would go back and completely rewrite it and take jargon out. So I had to like remove layer upon layer of science speak. And I think what I ended up with is something that's really fun. I basically just thought, like, what is the craziest analogy I can think of for the concept that I'm trying to convey? I don't know. I talk about like Missy Elliott's Flip It and Reverse It song, which I think is just a fantastic song. And it's a great analogy for DNA sequencing.
I love it, and I ask that question because I do know that you were very intentional about making sure that myself and others that don't work in this can pick this up and understand it and have a grasp of it. And I think it's interesting for us to have this greater understanding of what we're standing on and what's beneath the surface.
Yeah, well, we got a minute or so. I got a text from a listener who wanted to know about deserts and microbial life in desert settings. Did you visit desert-like settings?
Yeah, so deserts are amazing because you can often turn over a rock or flick a couple of layers off the outside of a rock, mm-hmm. and there will be a green line inside the rock. So the name of the game there is surviving the onslaught of sunlight. And so one way to do it is to hide inside rocks, which I just think is fascinating.
And surviving in the absence of water.
Right, so the water's there. It's just not in high abundance.
Okay.
And so I sort of maybe counterintuitively, the problems that people face in deserts, who study microbial life in deserts or any life in deserts, are similar to what we do in permafrost, because there's plenty of water in permafrost, but it's all crystalline in the form of ice.
So is water then still a common requirement for all of these microbes?
Yep.
Oh.
We have never found something that cannot get by without water. And we have not found something that does not have DNA just yet.
Okay.
These are things that seem to be common for absolutely every inch of life on Earth so far.
So they're breathing from the periodic table, but they have to have water. Oh, that's so fascinating.
That's right.
No.
That's right.
Oh, wow. Well, this is such such fantastic work that you're doing. We're glad that you put out this book so that we can all better understand what is happening beneath the surface. So thank you so much for being a part of This Green Earth. It's Karen Lloyd, who has just penned the book, Intraterrestrials, Discovering the Strangest Life on Earth. And where can people find you or your work? Do you have a website?
My website is, it's kind of in flux right now, but it's at the University of Southern California. You can find it. But the book is wherever you buy books.
Right.
It's in Amazon, whatever.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Karen.
Thanks, Karen.
Thanks for having me.
All right. We are going to be back. And I had a conversation with wildlife photographer Will Berard Lucas, who is going to bring us more information about traipsing across Africa in the Congo to Ethiopia and the endangered species he found there. We'll be right back. And welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley, and joining us now is Will Berard Lucas. Now, Will is a wildlife photographer who mainly works in Africa, but has gone into the depths of many places that most of us don't get to go, and has also invented something called a beetle cam. We're going to get into all of that right now. Will, thanks for joining us on This Green Earth.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Let's first get a bit of a background on yourself. As I understand it, you had your formative years in Tanzania, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So when I was a young boy, we moved to Tanzania and spent about 3 or 4 years living there. And those were very formative years for me. So some of my earliest memories are of being on a safari with my family. And you know, ever since that time, I've had this sort of passion for Africa and for wildlife and for nature. And I've been very lucky to have found a way in my grown-up life to be able to return regularly and explore more of the continent.
I had someone say to me once that once you taste the waters of Africa, you're always thirsty, which I feel is very true.
Yeah.
So was it as a early child that you wanted to capture these things, or that you had this inclination to see the world in a different way and capture it differently?
I think I always did have that instinct and desire to capture some of these experiences and some of this beauty that I was experiencing. But it didn't come together in those early years. You know, I might have experimented with painting or my mother's film camera, but for me, it never really clicked until digital cameras came along. And that was the point where I guess the tools married up with my creativity, and I managed to actually start to translate what it was that I wanted to capture into a medium that I could then use to go back and relive some of these memories and also share them with other people. And so digital was definitely a turning point for me, and that's the point where photography really took off, and pretty soon my passion for photography and for nature and wildlife kind of fused together, and I found myself traveling more and more with the primary purpose of photographing wildlife, and was able to build it up to the point where I was able to make it my career about 15 years ago now.
We're going to get into some of the technology that you invented, but first, because this is This Green Earth, and we are a lot about conservation here and protecting the planet and having a reverence for our natural world. So I'm curious how this relationship to your camera and wildlife, you at some point wanted to not only take these pictures, but also help protect the animals. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, I think it's not really possible to spend a lot of time in these places without becoming very aware of the challenges that these ecosystems and this wildlife faces. And wherever you are in the world, very different species and different environments. You know, there are these problems that they all seem to face, some specific and some more general. And so, you become very aware of these things, whether it's drought affecting elephants or deforestation or human encroachment. Obviously, being passionate about these places and then seeing that destruction and those challenges, it makes it hard to just be a bystander without trying to do something to help. And then as I started to establish myself and get my career going, I naturally found myself partnering with conservation organizations a lot. And so they would help me with access and help me get the photos. And in turn, I was taking photos that they could then use for their purposes. And so by partnering with conservation organizations, you can see firsthand both the challenges and the solutions and how photography can help them further their goals. And so really from the earliest days of turning professional, it's been very much this symbiotic relationship between me and conservation organizations, and trying to put my photography to as much good use as possible whenever possible.
Yeah, and I understand that you had a bit of a knack for technology, and you also had this love of wildlife. So you developed something called a beetle cam. Can you walk me through what a beetle cam is and what sparked this idea?
Yeah, sure. So I guess as I was trying to find my way as a wildlife photographer, work out, you know, what sort of images I wanted to take and what for me made a special photograph, I found myself experimenting with different perspectives and techniques. And one thing that really appealed to me and wasn't commonly seen back when I was getting started was getting closer to wild subjects and using a wide angle lens to then bring in much more of the habitat around them. And so whereas with a telephoto lens, which is what's more typically used in wildlife photography, you get this very shallow depth of field and narrow field of view. By getting closer, I was able to place animals in their habitats and, for me, create photos that were much more intimate and more impactful. And so I was able to experiment with this and sort of start to take these sort of photos by getting close to animals that I could get close to safely, whether that's, you know, macro subjects or animals that are habituated, such as meerkats in Botswana. And I really fell in love with this perspective, but the subjects I wanted to photograph in this way, it would have been far too dangerous to crawl up to them without getting mauled or trampled to death. And so I've always enjoyed creating all sorts of things and inventing things. And I decided that in order to try and capture something a bit different, it was worth investing a bit of energy and taking a few risks to see if I could create something that would allow me to achieve this perspective. And so for me, the solution was kind of obvious. I decided to build this remote control buggy, which I could stick my camera on and see if I could use that to get my camera closer to animals in Africa, such as lions and elephants. And I had no idea how the animals would respond and whether it would be, you know, capture anything at all, but I figured it was worth the risk. And so back in 2009, I created the first version of Beetlecam, as I called it, and got just enough from my first field test of it in Tanzania, enough positive results to prove the concept. Unfortunately, that expedition ended a bit disastrously when my camera was fairly quickly destroyed by a lion. But I saw the potential and realized if I could lion-proof it, I could potentially get a lot more. And the results I did capture from that one encounter of the lion approaching the camera certainly captured people's attention. So I knew I was onto something, and I've continued to evolve the design, and a couple of years later returned with a lion-proof version, and it managed to survive a two-week trip in Kenya with that, and I've continued to strengthen it and improve it, and now it's one of those tools in my toolbox, which allows me to capture that intimate close-up perspective of these sort of powerful, charismatic creatures such as lions, leopards, rhinos, elephants, hyenas, all of these amazing creatures.
We have talked on this program about some of the perils that some of the animals that you just mentioned are going through and allowing for better study or understanding through this camera work. You can help. I know that you've partnered, like you said, with different organizations. It looks like you partnered with the Tsavo Trust as well on the Big Tusker Project. And even though banning the ivory trade, I think it was around 1990 that happened. To this day, this is still an issue. Can you talk to me about this partnership with Tsavo Trust, why was it important to you, and what's happening still out there in these wild places where people still are getting involved in that ivory trade?
Yeah, so Tsavo Trust was set up, it must have been maybe 12, 13 years ago now, and it was set up really in direct response to this massive spike in ivory poaching in Kenya, set up by Richard Moller, a conservationist. And he was very familiar with the Tsavo ecosystem and these last remaining big tuskers that they have there. So these are elephants with huge tusks weighing more than 100 pounds on each side. And Tsavo has a huge elephant population as it is, but the elephants were getting targeted quite ferociously by the poachers. And Richard, you know, could see if nothing was done within a couple of years, they could easily all be wiped out. And so they set about prioritizing protecting the big tuskers, and in doing so, they'd be protecting all the elephants in the area. So they had this big tusker project. And I became involved because these tuskers are very elusive. They live in these very remote parts of Tsavo. Tsavo itself is huge. It's about 40,000 square kilometers with very few roads. And so if you're driving through Tsavo, you know, these elephants are like looking for a needle in a haystack. And so they're very elusive, live in very remote parts of the park and are very hard to find. But the Tsavo Trust were able to keep tabs on them by flying daily and monitoring their position, and then targeting their anti-poaching patrols in areas where they knew these tuskers were hanging out. But really for them, the challenge was showing people what it is that we were trying to protect, because there were very few images of a lot of these animals except from taken from high up in the air. And so together we partnered to put together a book that would show these big tuskers and more generally the habitat and other elephants in the area, put together a book, and then Tsavo Trust could use that to show stakeholders and donors and, you know, the local community, even, you know, some of these creatures that, you know, they were putting all this effort into protecting. So the people can have a, you know, feel that connection and understand a bit more about what they're attempting to achieve. And so we spent, over the course of about a year, I went backwards and forwards a few times to join their teams and track down these tuskers. And it was an incredible privilege to be able to find and photograph them. And Betelcam was actually a tool that came in very useful in that project, because that perspective with these incredible elephants with tusks sweeping down and touching the ground, you know, basically sort of arcing down towards the lens of my camera on Betelcam, created some very impactful photos. And yeah, just a dream project, and a book that came out of it, which I titled Land of Giants, is something that I'm very proud of.
Yeah, if people can get a greater understanding of the plight these animals are going through and have a little bit deeper connection with them, they tend to want to act, I guess, or give to organizations. And you also have gone into different areas in the Congo, which is really interesting to me, and photographed there in a national park.
Bali and Doki. Yeah. So, yeah, for me, really what gets me excited is being able to show people things they haven't seen before. And either that's doing something like Beetlecam to show people a new perspective, or it's going somewhere different, photographing animals and habitats where, you know, relatively few photographers have gone before. And so the Congo for me is one of those places with great allure, because really it's a vast swathe of Africa, but very little has come out of it in terms of photography. And so it's always been somewhere that's had this draw, and I managed to visit previously, but just briefly. So I'd had a bit of a experience there, but then this opportunity came up to partner with WCS, who have been working for quite a long time now, I think 3 decades or so, to protect this area that's a national park in the Republic of Congo, right up in the north on the border with Cameroon and Central African Republic. And it's this huge swathe of pristine forest that's never been logged. And, you know, it's not got no roads going into it. The only access into it is on foot. So it feels very remote and untouched. But one of the problems they have, which I guess mirrors the Tsavo Trust and that project, is that they had all this incredible diversity of wildlife there, but not a lot of imagery of it. And so in the rainforest particularly, a lot of the wildlife is very elusive, and it's there, but actually going there, seeing it and photographing it is almost impossible. As you're walking through the forest, you're aware that you're surrounded by animals. You see signs of animals everywhere, from, you know, footprints on the paths, or you hear their calls or rustles in the undergrowth. But the vegetation is so dense that you can't see it. It's always out of sight. To actually photograph it is quite a challenge. And so that's where our partnership kind of came together, because one of the things I specialize in is camera trap photography. And so that's come about as a kind of evolution of Beetlecam. With Beetlecam, I could use it to capture quite bold animals that I could drive a buggy in front of and they wouldn't run away. But in about 10 years or so ago, I kind of got frustrated that there were a huge number of animals that were too skittish for me to photograph in that way. And so that's when I started using camera traps, which are basically stationary cameras with a sensor that detects when an animal's in front and automatically triggers the camera. And I'm using high quality cameras in these systems, the same type I would use for my handheld photography. So I've got the image quality there. I'm using off camera lights to get nicely lit photos of animals at night. And really it allowed me to capture that close up Beetlecam perspective of shire creatures, but also opened up more of the world of nocturnal wildlife, because I could use lighting to expose the night like I couldn't before. And so camera traps have become a huge part of many of the projects that I do, and a perfect application for them was on this Congo project. And we took out 5 of these high quality camera trap setups, and I spent a year, over the course of the year, I went out 3 times to set up cameras, and then returned 2 more times to then move them about to get more variety and to try and capture more different species. And over the course of the year, managed to capture a whole range of rarely photographed animals, which then could feed into all sorts of communications materials for the WCS could use, showing the communities around the park, some of the animals that they were working to protect, and all sorts of things like that.
And of course, the Wildlife Conservation Society is what you're referring to with WCS. And yeah, there is a lot to be said, not only in studying these animals to see their survival, but also their ecosystem. And when humans impact an environment that these animals are in, how devastating that can actually be, because there are a lot of endangered species that call the Congo their habitat.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, a lot of these habitats are very threatened, either through things like logging or, you know, in other rainforests, felling for palm oil or whatever it is. And so, you know, all these species, a lot of them are very poorly studied, and yet they may be gone before we fully understand much about them, simply because their habitats are disappearing.
Mm-hmm. And some of these can be considered to be keystone species for their specific environment, so that when you see the collapse of an ecosystem, a lot of times it is because something has been eradicated or taken out and it stops the balance in that system. So it's really interesting to see these photographs and see these animals as they go about their day-to-day lives, but also it is very telling on what is happening in that area.
Yeah, and really, I think the success of the project and the number of images and species that we did get shows just how, I guess, successful the conservation efforts have been. And, you know, these researchers and conservationists who've been intensively working there for 30 years or so, you know the area so well. They've spent so much time researching and understanding these animals and habitats that they were really crucial in helping me capture the photos, because they were able to basically show me the best places to capture the different species that I was after. And really, without that partnership and without their knowledge, yeah, we would have been much less successful. But by partnering in this way, we were able to achieve everything we hoped for, really.
So I have two more areas I want to cover, and I know that we're running out of time here, but I first want to talk about the black leopard and how elusive that is, and that you were able to capture these phenomenal nocturnal photos of this animal. Tell us a little bit about the black leopard.
Yeah, so this is probably my just the biggest dream of a project I've ever been involved in. And so until this project, very few photos had ever come out of Africa of a black leopard. Most of the pictures that had been taken were taken in India and Asia, where black leopards are much more prevalent. But every now and then you'd hear a rumor or a whisper that there'd been a black leopard seen somewhere in Africa. And it always kind of got my heart racing. And in during the Tsavo project, actually, in around 2008, I heard via a friend in the tourism industry that a black leopard had been seen up in this area of Kenya called Laikipia. And it was a young one, and apparently had been seen a few times. And my ears pricked up, because it sounded like the sort of opportunity where maybe if I was really, really lucky, I might be able to get a photograph of it. And so I got in touch with the camp owner who'd seen this leopard, and he confirmed, you know, that it was there and hopefully was still there. And so within a couple of months, I'd got my camera traps together and went out there to set them up and see if we could get it. And I really didn't have the highest hopes of success, because, you know, it's like one cat in this vast landscape, and nobody even knew if it was still there. But for me, the opportunity, even if it was slight, to photograph it, meant I had to give it a go. And to cut a long story short, within the first 2 weeks, we got a first photo of it. And it was such a stunning subject from my point of view that I pretty much then exclusively focused on it for over a year, going out again and again to refine my camera traps, moving them around, keep trying to capture more spectacular photographs of it. And really the only reason the project ended is because then COVID came along and meant I couldn't go out for a while, and the black leopard during that time kind of grew up and ended up moving off. But I was able to capture enough over the course of the year to do a book about that as well. So that was my last book. And just for me, the creativity that I could put into it in terms of figuring out ways to light a black creature in the black of night, you know, under the stars, with moonlit backgrounds behind. You know, there's so much to do there, and such a unique subject that it was, yeah, as I say, a dream project.
Yeah, the photographs are absolutely stunning. And I also wonder, because I can get emotionally involved when I'm on safari with these animals and just the protection of them. Did you have any of those feelings around this black leopard that you had been working with for this long and watching it? Were there any moments of like, oh, is it in peril, or did you have any of that?
So these areas of this is private land and very well protected. You know, you've got these species like elephants lions and things on this land. That means that already there's anti-poaching work, for example, to keep the elephants safe. And, you know, Kenya's got very strict rules and safeguards in place to keep wildlife protected. Obviously, want to keep it protected and have its best interests at heart. And so having to find ways to, I guess, manage that and keep it safe. And yeah, from what I've seen, I think they're achieving it.
Well, that's good to hear. And the last one I want to touch on is the wolves of Ethiopia. I don't know that anyone would expect actually to have wolves there, but there is an Ethiopian wolf. You had a chance to go out there and kind of study this animal and photograph it as well. Can you tell us about the Ethiopian wolf?
Yeah, so this is another amazing project. And actually now quite a long time ago, it was 2012, I think, I was out there doing that project in partnership with an American photographer called Rebecca Jackrell. And yeah, these wolves, they're incredible. They're most closely related to the grey wolves in Europe, and they would have come down, I guess, around the Ice Age or so. And they then became marooned in these highland areas of Ethiopia. So several populations all kind of cut off from each other just in these highlands. And one of the biggest populations was in the Bale Mountains, which is where we partnered with the Ethiopian Wolf Conservation Program to document the wolves and again put together a book for them. And we spent about, I think, 6 or 7 weeks there. And these wolves, they most of the year they move around. They're mostly specialized in hunting rodents. There's this incredibly high density of mole rats and grass rats and other rodents in the area. And so that's what these wolves have kind of evolved to hunt, and they hunt solitarily, but then come together just as other wolves in these social packs when it comes to raising cubs. And so we went there during the denning season, which is about the only time these wolves can be pinned down to an area when they've got cubs in the den. And we're able to spend several weeks with several different packs photographing them as they return to the den and pups started coming out of the den for the first time. So a really special experience to be able to spend time with these animals, see their behavior and document these pups. And yeah, incredibly endangered, very few wolves left. And yeah, there's both their habitat is so limited in terms of size, and then there's such challenges such as they're kind of surrounded by communities with domestic dogs, and these dogs can bring in devastating diseases like rabies and distemper. So waves of diseases pass through the population every few years, and so keeping both the domestic dogs and now also the wolves vaccinated is a huge task for the conservationists, and also just protecting this very rare and fragile habitat.
For us looking on this and not really being able to experience this ourselves, but to live vicariously through your books, through your photography, and to gain a greater understanding, and hopefully to also have more of an empathy for the plight of these animals and these conservationists that are trying to keep these ecosystems intact and keep these species alive. So I am really curious to know what your next project might be.
Okay, so I've got a couple on the go at the moment. One in Namibia, where we're trying to photograph some of the more unusual desert-adapted nocturnal species, things like aardvarks and pangolins and brown hyenas. And so I've been working on that for a few months. And then in Kenya, where we're focusing on rhinos there. So in some really beautiful habitats as well. So yeah, being able to capture animals in their habitat is something that I really enjoy trying to do, but it's a huge challenge. And so I'm enjoying that project and putting my equipment and techniques to the test.
Tell us how people can learn more about you, your photography, and to get your books.
Yes, yeah, so WillBL, WILLBL.com, or at WillBL on Instagram and various other places. If you search that, you should be able to find my work and links to all the things like books and so on.
Well, Will, we appreciate you being on This Green Earth.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a pleasure.